loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Tomorrow's the presidential election in the United States, but how democratic is this system really? We'll look at how the boundaries of electoral constituencies has been used to undermine democracy and the unpopular system known as the Electoral College. Nicaragua's elections took place yesterday with the Sandinistas and President Daniel Ortega achieving victory once again for a third consecutive time since 2006. What accounts for the success and popularity of the Sandinistas today, 37 years after their revolution first ushered them to power? The Pentagon has awarded Lockheed Martin a $6.1 billion contract for new F-35 fighter planes, but the company isn't happy with the decision, which was made only by the Pentagon. Could it be that the F-35 program has been deemed less profitable than originally expected? But first, we turn to the electoral system in the United States. We are joined from Maryland by Drew Penrose. He's the legal director at the election reform advocacy organization Fair Vote. And in studio by Bob Schlehuber, producer of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Puryear. Welcome, Drew and Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining. Drew, we have both a U.S. and a global audience. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you define the term gerrymandering and explain the first-past-the-post system?
I certainly can. So gerrymandering has a long history in the United States, but it's really come to the forefront in modern times when its use has both become more sophisticated and more obvious. So the way that we elect our Congress, you know, the House of Representatives, 435 members, and it's allocated to various states, different numbers of representatives. So like Louisiana gets six, but they can't just elect all six statewide or however they want. They're required under federal law, not under the Constitution, but under a federal law that was passed in the 1960s, to divide into six districts and only elect one in each district. Well, when you do that, then a district, overwhelmingly, the districts are either going to be safe for the Republican Party or safe for the Democratic Party, the two major parties in the United States. And so by drawing the district lines, you're effectively deciding who's going to be, what character of representation the state is going to have. Gerrymandering is when you do that deliberately to actually influence the results of that. So instead of just drawing square districts or drawing districts that follow county lines, you'll typically look at the partisan makeup of the population of your state and then draw districts to make sure that you'll maximize the number of Republicans being elected or maximize the number of Democrats being elected or just keep the incumbents in office, that sort of thing. That's what gerrymandering is. And it's really caused by the fact that we only use single winner districts in the United States.
Right. So both parties, both the Republicans and Democrats, are guilty of gerrymandering, right?
Absolutely. It's more widely thought of right now as a Republican thing, and that's just sort of an accident of history. So districts are redrawn every 10 years after the census. And as it happens, 2010 was a very strong Republican year. And so Republicans took over a lot of state legislatures that they didn't have before. And so they had the authority to draw district lines. So most states that are very obviously gerrymandered are gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. But you can easily find Democratic examples. So where I am right now, Maryland, is a really obvious example of a Democratic gerrymander, for example. If you look at the district map for Maryland, it's obviously drawn with the intent to influence the results. And the state legislature will actually, frankly, admit it, that their goal was to reduce the number of Republicans that would be elected to Congress from the state.
So the state legislatures or bipartisan commissions can decide how the state will be reconfigured. How it will be reconfigured, they look at the demographics. They kind of know based on demographic patterns and voting patterns whether people in a particular neighborhood are voting Democratic or Republican. They can reorganize the actual physical shape of a district. And by doing that, they can determine pretty much which party is going to win.
Which party is going to win each district. That's absolutely right. But whether it's the legislature intentionally doing it to influence the results or it's done by an independent redistricting commission or something like that, even if it's done completely blindly, the nature of single winner districts is such that you're going to have most districts be safe for one political party or the other. You tend to not have very many competitive districts. And it's very rare. It would be sort of a happy accident for the districts to happen to wind up reflecting the state fairly overall. You get distortions pretty much no matter what you do. But intentional gerrymandering is where you have a plan from the outset and you put that into effect.
And before I bring Bob Schlehuber into this discussion, Drew, I want to have you again help our audience, which is both national and global. And even the national audience won't really understand how the American electoral system works because it's so Byzantine, it's so strange. But how does then the gerrymandering, say, of congressional districts impact the possible presidential outcome? Because there is a direct correlation between congressional districts and the Electoral College, which is ultimately who decides who the next president will be. Talk about that.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that. Most states, it actually doesn't matter. 48 out of the 50 states, the electors, so the number of electors that a state gets is the number of congressional representatives that it has. So, for example, a state like Louisiana, I mentioned earlier, has 6 representatives in Congress. It also has 2 senators because every state has 2 senators. So as a result, that means Louisiana has 8 electors. And that's true for all of the states. But 48 out of the 50 states just award all of those electors to whoever wins the most votes statewide in the state. So that's a winner-take-all system. And that's used in 48 of the states. And basically it's because, you know, if a state tends to vote Republican, let's say, then probably it has a Republican majority in the legislature, and they want all of their electoral votes to go to the Republican nominee for president. So they set it up that way, that whoever gets the most votes will win all of the electors. That's true in 48 states. Nebraska and Maine are the only two that do it by congressional district. But those are both fairly small states, so the issue of gerrymandering doesn't come up. Now, that's relevant because the winner-take-all system has come under a lot of criticism. Not that many people like it anymore, and it's easy to see why, because when all of the electors are going to go to whoever wins the most, there's really no point in campaigning in a state that's obviously going to go to the Republican nominee or to the Democratic nominee, which is why you basically never see the presidential candidates showing up in a place like New York or Alaska or California, these really strongly partisan states. They only campaign in the competitive states. One of the proposals to change that has been to say, well, let's stop electing all of our electors statewide for the winner. Let's do it by congressional district. But actually, that turns out to be even worse than the current system, because if you do it that way, then it really ramps up the impetus to gerrymander, and you can wind up with hugely distorted results. And just looking at the congressional results can show you that. Like in 2012, for example, more voters voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives than for Republicans, but Republicans won the most seats. That kind of distortion is sort of baked in to the congressional district map, and that could be a real problem for the presidential election system if it were implemented.
Okay, I want to bring in Bob Schlehuber. He is the producer for By Any Means Necessary, a show here on Radio Sputnik. It's By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Puryear. Bob, we're talking about gerrymandering. We're talking about the electoral system. We're also talking about the Electoral College, because when people vote on Tuesday, they think they're voting either for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Gary Johnson or Jill Stein or Gloria Larriva or one of the candidates. The Democrats or Republicans obviously will be the victor there, but they're actually not voting for the person who they think they're voting for. They're voting for electors, and the electors in the Electoral College ultimately determine who will be president. Sometimes individuals win the popular vote, like Al Gore did in 2000, and lose the Electoral College. You need 270 Electoral College votes. The people of the United States have been stuck with this system for a long time, but you're out on the streets and you're asking people, do they actually support the system? Talk about that.
Yeah, so I was out there for an hour walking around just a few blocks here where our office sits near the White House, and I could not find a single person that was for the Electoral College. I interviewed maybe 10 people and then talked to another 10 handful of people on the street, every single person said the same thing. It should be a popular vote. It's not properly representative of people's thoughts when we simply have the Electoral College. And looking at the vote totals in 2012, I think what happens is ultimately we think the other parties outside the Democrats and Republicans got zero votes. You know, I mean, not a single one of them got electoral votes, but you had over 1 million votes for the Libertarian Party. The Green Party came over 500,000 votes, and the other candidates on the ballot accumulated over 750,000 votes. Now, that's over 2 million people who don't make it into the conversation the next day. That's 2 million people that seemingly disappear because of the Electoral College.
Okay, Bob, I want to be able to have our audience hear some of the comments that you received when you were out on the street today.
I think we should try something else because of what happened in 2000 with Al Gore, when the voting machines in Florida were outdated and antiquated, especially right now. They're like 20 years old, the versions of the voting machines at that time. So I think something else needs to be done because the Electoral College doesn't really give an adequate count of the true voters.
There has to be a different model. Apparently, I mean, every election we have an issue with it. Of course, the candidates do, especially the ones that lose. But I think something has to be said about the popular vote. It best represents everyone's opinion.
I believe that all voting should be by popular vote, that the president should be elected by popular vote.
I think we could go with a different model for selecting a president.
I don't think it's an accurate way to represent the American people's opinion, because if you're having the American people vote for who represents them, it's not fair to have someone else interpret their vote, especially when it's not going to be majority.
I think it can be controversial at times, especially when it goes against what the populace says.
I think it's outdated, it's antiquated, it should be a straight percentage total, just like any real election.
I think it's misunderstood. The people in this country need to understand what it is and how their votes count towards it. I think it was better understood. There will be more clarity on the issue, and from there we can decide if it's something we want to keep.
Okay, Bob Schlehuber, that was unanimous. That vote was unanimous. People don't like the system. They want a popular vote, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it would just be fascinating to watch the shift if we did go to popular vote. I think the way in which we have elections would dramatically shift, just as Drew is saying. I mean, there's such focus around those swing states. And you'd see a rush to the major media markets in major locations where you could allocate the bigger vote totals. So you'd see a large shift to New York City, to the Chicago metropolitan area, to the Los Angeles area, to California. So all of a sudden, you'd see a dramatic change in how U.S. elections are run to states that often aren't in play. All of a sudden, major cities now become the playground for these places, which the one concern I would have is for rural areas where there isn't much popular vote to be gained, that these rural voters would no longer count or almost be completely discarded because their one or two votes would all of a sudden have such a skyrocketed rate to be able to reach them through any platform. And you would see a larger shift towards urban areas, which ultimately I would argue would favor the Democrats, and it would be an interesting shift to see.
Okay, Drew Penrose is the legal director at Fair Vote. Drew, I want to ask you about a different way, a different system, because your organization, Fair Vote, which I really encourage people to go to Fair Vote website, it's very informative, very educational, and you have proposals. You have something called ranked choice voting, which is something you're advocating. Talk about what that is.
Sure. Ranked choice voting is a proposal for changing the way that we vote and the way that votes are counted to make sure that people have real choices on the ballot, and that the people who are ultimately elected are ones that have real support among the voters. It's going to be on the ballot this coming Tuesday, actually, in the state of Maine for adoption for all of their state offices. Under ranked choice voting, instead of merely filling in a bubble next to one candidate, and then if that candidate can't win, well, oh well, your vote is gone. It counted for the candidate who lost. That's the end of the story. And then a candidate can win with, 35% of the vote or 40% of the vote if there are a bunch of candidates all competing against each other. Under ranked choice voting, you would rank the candidates. Here's my first choice, but here's my second choice if that first choice can't win. Here's my third choice, my fourth choice, and so on. That way, you count the first choices first, And if somebody has a majority, they're going to win just like under any other election. But if nobody has a majority, then you can eliminate the candidate in last place. And if your favorite candidate is eliminated, your vote instantly goes to your second choice. So that way you can keep doing that until a candidate gets that majority. And that way you can feel confident that the candidate who is elected ultimately is the one that really has majority support among the voters. It's on the ballot in Maine in part because Maine has a history of having a lot of choices on the ballot, but then electing candidates with less than a majority. 9 out of the last 11 governor's elections in Maine have been won with less than 50%, 5 of them less than 40%. So when a candidate is winning election with 35, 37% of the vote, it raises a lot of questions as to whether that candidate was really the one that best represents the people who voted in that election. Ranked choice voting really helps to take care of that problem. You know, it's a simple solution that could really have a big impact.
Drew, I want to ask you, we have less than 1 minute now. It has existed in the past in the United States. I think isn't it the same as proportional representation? I mean, you had in New York City on the city council in the 30s, that kind of system whereby even socialists and even members of the Communist Party were elected to the city council because people could have their first, second, and third choice. And as a consequence, you got a better sense of where the populace actually stood. Is that right? Is that what it was?
That's a great comment. So the way that I was talking about it for Maine would only be to elect single winner offices. And single winner offices, that's all about getting a candidate who wins a majority. But you're right that actually if you use it to elect multi-winner contests, so for example, when New York City was using it, they would elect, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 candidates in a single area. Voters are ranking the choices, so ranking the candidates on their ballot. And then it actually does serve as a candidate-based proportional system. So people who are an international audience might be used to proportional representation as a party-based system where you vote for a political party rather than a candidate. This allows you to get that proportional representation, but you're voting for candidates. You vote for your favorite candidate first, your second favorite candidate, and so on. They actually still use it today in the city of Cambridge in that way. So the city of Cambridge elects its city council and its school board using what we would call a fair representation.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Cambridge leads the way. Let's find out what's happening in Cambridge. We've been talking from Maryland by Drew Penrose. He's the legal director at the election reform advocacy organization Fair Vote. Go to their website, Fair Vote. And we've been joined in studio by Bob Schlehuber, producer of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary with you, Gene Puryear. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The FSLN, or Sandinista National Liberation Front, remains in power after once again coming to power in the 2006 elections. Recent surveys based on interviews conducted between May 15th and June 15th, 2016, indicated an approval rating of 69% for the government, the second highest rating in Latin America. Why is the FSLN so popular? Why did they come to power once again? We are joined from London by Luis Richard. She is the trade union and communications coordinator for the Nicaragua Solidarity Campaign Action Group. Welcome, Luis.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks for joining. What factors led to the FSLN returning to power in 2016? There was a 16-year period from 1990 to 2006 in which they were the political opposition. Talk about those years of neoliberalism and how it changed the country, and what's different today?
Well, those years were, as you say, years when right-wing governments, neoliberal governments were in power. And what they did was to implement policies that we're seeing actually in the UK at the moment, policies of austerity and privatization. So things like health and education were privatized. So people couldn't afford, if you couldn't afford health care, you didn't have access to health care. If people couldn't afford drugs and medicines, people couldn't afford to send their children to school. You've got things like during that period, illiteracy rose to 36% in the country. There were, in the public sector, because I link with trade unions in Nicaragua, in the public sector, two-thirds of public sector workers lost their jobs. There were mass redundancies and privatizations. People talk about, when you go to Nicaragua now, people talk about those years as a period of abandonment, really that they were forgotten. And certainly the poorest and most vulnerable in the country were those who suffered during those years.
The U.S. government, back in August of this year, 2016, issued a statement. The State Department issued a statement. The title is Concerns Regarding Nicaraguan Democracy and Elections. And then I'm going to read a first paragraph to you from it. It says, the United States is gravely concerned by the actions of the Nicaraguan government and Supreme Court to limit democratic space in advance of presidential and legislative elections in November. We strongly urge the Nicaraguan government to create a more open environment for free and fair elections that will allow the Nicaraguan people to determine the future of their country. Now, there's a whole lot there, given the fact that the United States waged an illegal covert war against the Sandinistas from the moment they took power in 1979 and for the next 11 years. Tens of thousands of Nicaraguans died. I want to talk about that. But what about the election process itself? Was it free? Was it fair?
Yes. I mean, every time that there is an election in Nicaragua, Western governments, and particularly the United States government, and the media, which is really fueled by the Western media, certainly fueled by the right-wing opposition, every time they start shouting foul and there's, you know, the fraudulent elections and they're not open, there's no democratic space. That's completely, completely untrue. I've seen on Twitter only today, there were on social media, the government has been putting out instructions to people on the voting process, how to vote. They've got people there from the region who are accompanying the election scrutineers. The Office of Organization of American States has now been invited to send people to Nicaragua. And in fact, there are 16 parties contesting the elections. They're organized into two alliances. So it's completely wrong to say that there's no democracy in Nicaragua, that there's no space. There's plenty of space for discussion, for debate. And what Nicaragua is all about is about popular participation. So there are lots of opportunities for people in communities, people in all sorts of areas in Nicaragua to participate. And they do have a very open democracy in the country. I would say as well that one of the criticisms has been that the press, for example, is controlled by the FSLN. That's completely not true. The right-wing press in Nicaragua, the opposition press, is free to operate. You can go online and go into Confidencial, which is one of those publications. Some of the civil society groups even have their own television stations. So all of these accusations, I just don't recognize.
Let me ask you about the history of the FSLN, because for many of our listeners, and we have both an audience here in the United States and a global audience, but for many people, probably the majority of people in the world today were not alive at the time of the Sandinista Revolution or even during the period of the Contra War that went on during the 1980s. Talk about the Sandinista Revolution of 1979, how it changed the face of Nicaragua, in what ways, and how was pre-revolutionary Nicaragua different to the country that was built under the Sandinistas?
Okay, well, pre-revolution Nicaragua was ruled by a dictatorship, by the Somoza dictatorship. Family was in power, I think for over 30 years they were in power. And that was a dictatorship, a corrupt dictatorship. There were allegations of human rights abuses. The Somoza and President Somoza and his family amassed a large fortune for themselves. Everything was very tightly controlled in the country. And certainly all power, land, that sort of thing was in the hands of the wealthy and the elite of the country. The revolution came and overthrew that dictatorship, really to get rid of the corruption and the human rights violations and to transform society. It's kind of what you're seeing today in Nicaragua. They call the second stage of the revolution. It's a transformation of society, having a society where equality, economic and social justice are important and where the programs that are being implemented are designed to for everybody and to help the poorest and most vulnerable in society and not just the wealthy few. The Contra War was quite incredible that President Reagan unleashed a war in the 80s against this country, against Nicaragua. It's less than the size of England and Wales, this small country, seeing it as a threat to the mighty and powerful United States. Ronald Reagan financed mercenaries from outside the country who came in and wreaked absolute devastation on the country. They laid mines, they blasted ports. I was there during that time, saw ports destroyed, saw young lives destroyed. Thousands and thousands of deaths were caused during that war, and the economy was just, some of the legacies even seen today, the economy was just completely ruined.
You know, it's quite amazing when I look at the U.S. State Department document from John Kirby, Admiral Kirby, in August 2016, talking about the need for free and fair elections and to make sure that Nicaragua and Nicaraguans could determine their own destiny and freedom. And then you think about the fact that when they had a revolution against a dictatorship that had killed thousands of people, banned the political opposition, was completely corrupt, when they had that revolution, first under Jimmy Carter and then even more in an exponential way under the Reagan administration, the U.S. financed a civil war using the troops of the old dictatorship under the National Guard to wreak such havoc on Nicaragua. Tens of thousands of people died. That, I think at that time the country was about 2.5 million people. And that war seemed like it was going to never end until the election in 1990, where the ruling party, the Revolutionary Party, the Sandinista Party, FSLN, finally gave up power. It was very unusual. I can remember vividly at the time because it seemed so unfair that the Sandinistas could lose under the circumstances of a financed and armed foreign counter-revolutionary war. And yet the Sandinistas abided by the election outcome and they went into the political opposition. At that time, it seemed like all was lost. In other words, the revolution that came in that had so much optimism and euphoria in 1979 had given way to the Contra War. It looked like the U.S. had really succeeded. But it's a long process, isn't it?
It is, but it was kind of in 1990, it was this kind of what's happening now as well, this, what I call psychological warfare. It's sort of, it's not going to war with guns and as was during the Contra War, but it's psychological. It's a kind of economic, a low-level warfare, which it seeks to destabilize. And when I've been speaking to people in Nicaragua about what happened in 1990, and basically they said we went to those elections, the Sandinistas went to those elections, not with a physical gun, but with a gun to our heads all the same. And this was the United States in particular making threats, as they are doing now with this latest potential NECA Act, which is saying, you know, if you don't dance to our tune, we're going to stop all grants, all loans to you, and we're going to ruin your economy again. So, again, that was a big factor in 1990, I think, when the Sandinistas did lose power.
Yeah, in the NECA Act that you're talking about is the Nicaraguan Investment Conditionality Act that's been proposed in Congress that would make multilateral loans to Nicaragua dependent on free, fair, and transparent elections, which in U.S. vernacular, U.S. diplomatic vernacular means if the candidates that the United States wants win, then it's a free and fair and transparent election. And if the other candidates win, then it's a tarnished election. It's a marred election. It's a fraudulent election. In other words, it really is, it is pure politics. So they're threatening, as you say, Luis, Nicaragua economically, and there's a kind of psychological warfare that goes with that. But talk about the economic strides that Nicaragua has made and also the strides in terms of civil and social security in the country, because they're quite remarkable in the last few years. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, Nicaragua, it's still, because of the legacy, a lot of the legacy of the neoliberal years, but it's still the second poorest country in the Americas after Haiti. But in spite of that, the Sandinista government, since it came to power again in 2007, has made huge, really transformed society. Poverty has decreased by some 13-14% in the country. They've reached the UN, United Nations Development Goals in terms of reducing hunger and malnutrition. Maternal mortality has been halved. There is free basic health care for everybody. Education spending has doubled and policies implemented so that children have access to good quality education. Nicaragua is now it's the safest country in Central America if you compare it to places like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Nicaragua is a very safe place now. During the neoliberal years, there were power cuts of some 16 hours a day. Now they're extending the sort of coverage of electricity more and more to all parts of the population, and the focus is very much on renewable energy. So they're hoping, the target is that there should be 90% renewable energy by 2020, and that has actually been praised again by the United Nations. Nicaragua has now been declared, I spoke earlier about under the neoliberal years, illiteracy had reached 36%. Nicaragua has now been declared virtually free.
That's an amazing achievement.
And there are all sorts of social programs for the poorest in society. They will get, there are programs which give them micro loans to start up businesses, other programs where a sow will be delivered to farmers, so that, and then the sow produces piglets, and then they can build up their farming business, and then they can feed their families. All sorts of programs to help poorer families in society.
Louise Richards is the person we're speaking to. She's talking to us from London. She is the trade union and communication coordinator for the Nicaragua Solidarity Campaign Action Group. We have about 2 minutes left, Louise. I want to ask you about the role of women in Nicaragua, the importance the FSLN places on women's participation, and also the unusual development that Rosario Murillo, the wife of Daniel Ortega, is the vice presidential running mate of Daniel Ortega in this election. That's unusual in the Western media, certainly in the New York Times and other places. They're making a big deal out of that. But she is, in her own right, a major political figure in the Nicaraguan Revolution and in Nicaragua today. So talk about those two things in our last 90 seconds or so.
Okay. I mean, in terms of women's participation, the programs I just talked about, the hunger program and the microcredits, they're particularly directed at women. So the idea is to give women more economic power in the country. But also in the Constitution, there has to be a minimum quota of 50% women candidates for party political and public office. And women's participation has certainly increased in their participation in the social and economic life of the country. And they have greater control of resources in the country. And Nicaragua has just reached, I think it's position 10 now in the World Economic Forum's 2015 Gender Gap Report, whereas the United Kingdom, I think, is at position 20, so they're actually better than the United Kingdom in that. Rosario is incredibly popular, probably as popular, if not more, than Danielle. She has played a really important role in terms of implementing the social programs that I've been describing. She is very much responsible for regularly communicating with the Nicaraguan population and, as you say, has played a very, very important and vital role in the political life of the country, but also, I think, in empowering women in the country. She's a kind of role model in terms of that empowerment.
Okay, Louise, we actually have about 45 more seconds. As you look forward, and I want to put this in a regional context, in Argentina, in Brazil, certainly earlier in Honduras, there has been a shift to the right, either through legislative coups like what happened in Brazil or electoral defeats for the left. There's a great crisis in Venezuela as a consequence of what they say is both economic and subversion, economic warfare and subversion by the U.S. and the elites in Venezuela. But here you have Nicaragua sort of going in the opposite direction. Talk about its regional significance. 30 seconds.
I think it's very significant, and I think the cooperation with Cuba, Venezuela, is very important, and I think the fact that the United States and others are trying to destabilize these three regimes that are going in the direction, a sort of left direction, that says it all, and I think it's very important that they work together and that they are allowed to continue their transformational social and economic programs. I think they do show, Nicaragua shows, Venezuela shows, Cuba shows, that an alternative model is possible.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right there. That was Louise Richards from London. She is the trade union and communications coordinator for the Nicaragua Solidarity Campaign Action Group. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Pentagon has awarded Lockheed Martin a $6.1 billion contract for new F-35 fighter planes, but the company isn't happy with the decision, which was made unilaterally by the Pentagon. The F-35 is a joint strike fighter, meaning it is theoretically supposed to carry out all types of combat. However, it is now over 7 years behind schedule and has cost over eight times as much as the Apollo program that put humans on the moon. But Lockheed Martin, the plane's manufacturer, is in fact perhaps laughing all the way to the bank as the program's price tag now approaches $1.5 trillion. To discuss the F-35, we are joined from Maryland by Pierre Spray, a lead member of the design team for the F-16 fighter aircraft. Welcome back, Pierre.
Oh, good to talk to you, Brian.
Let's start with your reaction to the unilateral contract given by the Pentagon to Lockheed Martin. Lockheed spokesperson Michael Raine said, "We are disappointed with the decision by the government to issue a unilateral contract action." What is this signal about the F-35 and its viability?
Very little. It's a tempest in a teapot compared to the disasters that are facing the program and that haven't happened yet. This is like a little tiny bump in the road. I mean, all that's happened is the government has done something very unusual. They very rarely do. Usually in these contract negotiations, you know, it's back and forth and finally both sides agree. Apparently they've been at it for well over a year and have had no agreement. And so the government, which has the right to do this, just unilaterally set the price of the contract. All that tells me is that Lockheed was being a bit too greedy for the government contracting officer. But this is a very minor perturbation. What's really facing them, from the point of view of money, is incredible schedule slips and a whole hidden raft of costs that nobody has admitted yet, which come in the next large lot called Block 4, which hasn't even been thoroughly defined yet. But it's the bill for it will be a Lollapalooza. So compared to that, this little argument over whether it's $6.1 billion or $6.2 billion, that's like a mosquito bite.
Yeah, I hear you. So the F-35 is the most expensive American weapon ever made. Its total cost, as I had mentioned earlier, could be about $1.5 trillion. That's 1,500 billions. Why is it still dealing with such serious problems, even after all these resources have been thrown at it?
Well, for the very simple reason that it costs too much, which tells you it's too complicated, which tells you it's basically not doable. The entire airplane is simply trying to tackle an impossibility. You know, and that dates back a long way. That dates back to the birth of this airplane. One thing people don't know is how ancient this whole program is. I mean, this thing is getting gray hair. It's so old. The actual design basics of the airplane were laid down between 1985 and roughly 1993. That's a long time ago. And the basics, you know, created a baked-in disaster. And that was very simple because they asked the airplane to do many missions, which right at the start is a very bad idea. No multi-mission airplane has ever been a success. There have been lots of single-mission airplanes, that were beautifully designed for their mission and then turned out to be useful in other missions. But when you sit down and decide that you want a Swiss Army knife, you know, for whatever, for a rifle, a truck, or an airplane, you're baking in disaster. And this is the largest and most ambitious Swiss Army knife ever created. Now, very simply, it started with the idea the Marines started this whole mess. They and the Blue Sky R&D people in the Pentagon's R&D branch, an outfit called ARPA, who have built a number of airplane prototypes, all of which have been a disaster and useless. In 1985, they decided that they wanted to do some great technological feat, something that they could brag about, you know, amongst engineers and airplane designers forever, that they would build the first successful supersonic vertical takeoff airplane. There had already been two international competitions that had shown that was impossible. Basically, you couldn't build a supersonic vertical takeoff airplane that was worth owning for any military mission. DARPA decided to ignore this. They could do it. And after the disappointing results of these international design competitions, they just went to Lockheed, to Lockheed Skunk Works. They turned the program black. That means they made it highly classified so nobody could know what they were up to, and funneled a whole bunch of money to Lockheed for the next 5 or 7 years for design work. Lockheed, of course, was more than happy to take the money and to tell them everything was going great, no problem. You know, our wind tunnel tests say, oh, yeah, you can take off vertically and you can go like blazes supersonically and you'll have a great airplane. The excuse for doing this, the military excuse, by the way, there is no real military mission for this at all. This is purely a technological feat. This is like, you know, circling the Earth once at, you know, at 5 times the speed of sound. It has no military purpose whatsoever. But the excuse, the Marines provided the cover for this, and they said, oh, we definitely need this because we already have a vertical takeoff airplane that's subsonic called the Harrier, which had already totally failed for close support, had proven to be totally useless for supporting Marine troops on the ground. And they said, but the Marines loved it because it was unique to them. It wasn't some hand-me-down from the Navy. And so they said, yeah, you know, the Harrier's getting kind of old. We need a replacement, and we certainly don't want to replace it with another subsonic vertical takeoff airplane. We need supersonic. So they signed up, and that was the cover story, that the Marines got to have it, and it's going to be great for Marine support of troops. And the Marines say it has to be supersonic, so that's what we're doing. You can see what kind of sin this was born in.
It's bureaucratic competition. It's the intertangling, perhaps the toxic intertangling of bureaucratic infighting, of people trying to create a legacy, creating something that will be very expensive and a long-term project that the taxpayers will. Once started, it's very hard to stop these programs. I mean, they just keep going and going and going.
And, of course, these people are all creating jobs for themselves when they retire. You got to remember there's a very strong financial motive here. If they can keep on funneling money to those contractors will save a nice little corner office for them when, you know, when they retire. So there's more than just engineering pride here.
You know, of course, President Eisenhower in his farewell address to the nation, that very famous speech, even though Eisenhower had a great deal to do with the creation of the military-industrial congressional complex, he warned the country very famously that it was a threat to democracy, that it had all sorts of other problems. The F-35, in some ways, seems to me, the little bit that I've been able to research about it, and you, of course, know a great deal more about it, it seems to be the epitome of the military-industrial congressional complex, because even the construction of it seems to be far-flung. In other words, a lot of people have some stake in this.
And that's totally deliberate. That's in the Pentagon, we call that political engineering. And what that is you artificially create subcontracts that you shouldn't. But you create subcontracted parts that you can farm out to 48 out of 50 states. And so you have a little contract in every place, you know, maybe even including Alaska. And that means that every senator and every congressman involved in the districts that have those contracts, they're going to get up and scream if anything happens to the funding. This is a way of locking in, you know, a weapon system, no matter whether it works or doesn't. And that's the whole heart of the F-35. This was an airplane that was designed to be a locked-in, politically engineered, huge project. And, you know, whether it worked or not was, you know, irrelevant and remains irrelevant, or they're trying to make it irrelevant. And basically the only thing that's standing in the way of that is the testing program. There's been a really rigorous director of testing in the Pentagon named Dr. Michael Gilmore. He set up a test plan for the F-35 that is, in fact, rigorous and realistic and tough. And the F-35, beyond the shadow of a doubt, will fail it. It's already failing its previous tests. Its development tests and operational tests are rougher. So what you'll be seeing happening now is Lockheed and, of course, all the Air Force proponents of big-money airplanes will be going after that testing office. They already are, to raise heaven and earth to make sure that this airplane does not get realistically tested, because when it does, it will fail. And it will be obvious to everybody that it's a danger to the pilots flying it and useless to the forces it's supposed to support.
We're speaking with Pierre Spray. He was a lead member of the design team for the F-16 fighter jet. Pierre Spray, the F-16, the F-35 was supposed to be a replacement, I believe, for the F-16 and the other generation, earlier generation of military aircraft. Based on your last comment, I was reading an article that we published in Sputnik, and it quoted a Vermont Air National Guard civilian pilot whose name was Adam Elpert, and he said, "If you get into a dogfight with the F-35, somebody made a mistake. It's like having a knife fight in a telephone booth. Very unpredictable." Could you explain what he means for our listeners? He's a pilot.
Sure. And by the way, this has already been tested, and what he said has been proven in tests to be exactly correct. The F-35, because of this terrible multi-mission requirement, has come up with a very fat fuselage, very small wings, very little lift, lots of weight, a tremendous amount of weight, a tremendous amount of drag. What all that tells you is it can't maneuver. It can't really turn. You have to have a lot of wing area relative to your weight to turn. This airplane has some of the heaviest loading of the wings of any fighter we've built since some really disastrous fighters of the 50s. So that means it can't turn. So, of course, the excuse of the proponents is, well, it's got stealth, and so nobody's going to see it, so it doesn't have to turn. Of course, that's betting on the come, because everybody in the world is busy developing sensors that defeat stealth, and the Russians are selling them on the open market. Radars and infrared sensors. So stealth is nothing to lean on. If you don't have stealth and you get into a war with, you know, with real air forces, I'm not talking about, you know, air forces that have, you know, 10 ancient MiG-21s or something, but if you had to fight a war against some larger country, there's no way that this airplane is just going to sit 100 miles from its enemies and lob missiles, because it's not going to be stealthy. And so it will be found. It has a huge infrared signature, by the way, which both European and Chinese and Russian sensors are being installed right now that will see that huge signature at anywhere from 50 to 80 miles. So once you have that, there's no way you can stay out of dogfights. You know, people will see you first, and if they see you first, they will jump you, and you will not know it, because they'll be smart enough to turn off their radios and their radars. And when they jump you, there's only one thing you can do. If you're lucky enough to see them as they're closing in, you got to maneuver hard to defeat their missiles or to defeat their aiming their gun. And if you don't have enough wing and you have too much drag and the airplane is too heavy, you know, it's a short life. That's what the guy is saying. When he's saying it's like if you get in a fight in a telephone booth, that's what a dogfight is. It's a fight in a very restricted area instead of just looking at enemies that are 30 or 50 or 100 miles away and deciding you're going to lob a missile at them. and not have to maneuver and hope that the missile will work, which it probably won't. That's not a knife fight. But when that fails, and there are, you know, three times as many enemy fighters as you have on your side, you're going to get bounced, and lots of those bounces will be by surprise, and you'll have nothing but a last-ditch maneuver to execute to save your life. And if the airplane doesn't have that maneuverability, you're stuck in that phone booth with somebody who's got a much bigger knife than you do.
Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have been competing with each other. Of course, the election is on Tuesday. Trump says the American military is in shambles, and Hillary Clinton says it's the greatest military ever, and we're going to keep it strong and keep our military alliances and keep the current system going. But, you know, neither of them are talking about these kind of issues like cost overruns, like the toxic intertangling between bureaucracy and profit and weapon system, the fact that the American people are paying so much, $600 billion, perhaps as much as a trillion when you look at all the different departments that carry out weapons procurement. And it seems like just a big rat hole, in fact. In other words, for corporate profit, really not about military efficacy or certainly protecting the people or spending the money that actually needs to be spent on other things that human beings need.
All of that is entirely correct. And there's simply no question that directly because of the excess money being spent on procurement, we have ruined the defense of the nation. It's a little hard for outsiders to understand how you can spend more money and get worse defense. But when the money is spent entirely or mainly on procurement, on procuring new and more complicated and more expensive weapons and suppressing their testing, when that happens, you wind up with soldiers, sailors, and airmen who are grossly undertrained because they can't even use their weapons because the weapons are constantly being fixed. And that's exactly what's happening on the air side, is pilots in the F-35 are horribly unprepared for combat because all they're getting is like 6 to 8 hours a month. I mean, this is unconscionable. At 6 to 8 hours a month, you're not even fully safe in a Piper Cub or a Cessna.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, Pierre. We are entirely out of time. I'm so sorry about that. I'd like to keep talking about it. We've been speaking with Pierre Spray. He was a lead member of the design team for the F-16. We've been talking about the unilateral contract that the Pentagon imposed on Lockheed Martin regarding the F-35, but we will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.